Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast, sponsored by cradiodifferently.com. I'm Tim Burrows.
And I'm Robin Hicks.
This week,
life after zoo.
Could we really see an Aussie media without POMs?
BMF's big changes.
Google eats the news industry's lunch.
The Walkley Awards, has WikiLeaks finally made it?
The year in TV.
The battle of catch-up TV.
With us today in the studios of CBS Interactive is Paul Merrill, magazine editor and author. Hi, Paul.
Good morning.
And podcast producer Colin Delaney.
Good morning, all.
Now, Paul, welcome along to the podcast. Probably best known in Australia as the editor and editor-in-chief of Zoo and the men's magazine stable of ACP. What are you up to these days?
Well, I left Zoo about 6 months ago now. And having decided I was too old and too washed out to edit men's mags any longer, since then I've written a book about the zoo story, which is coming out next year.
What's that called? Have you got a name for it?
At the moment, it's called "Can We Cook the Dwarf?" So that may or may not change. And then I've just started writing another series of books and doing a bit of consultancy here and there. And apart from that, being quite lazy, just spending time at home.
So I feel kind of weirdly like I've sort of stalked you across the globe, really. I remember in my days on Media Week in the UK, I think I first came across you as the editor, I think it was Chat.
That's right.
Where you gave a hilarious interview where you described your readers as something along the lines of having three different children by three different prisoners.
That was my... I became editor and full of my own ego and self-importance. I gave this hilarious interview to the sort of media, what's it called, Press Gazette. And of course, then when it appeared in print, it kind of didn't look quite as hilarious. I sort of did a Ratner, basically.
See, I found it hilarious.
Well, a lot of people found it hilarious, but my boss didn't find it hilarious.
Oh, really?
No, and I was hauled over the coals and royally told off. And you're right. I said that most of chat readers have three kids by different prisoners and, get machete attacks and wear leggings despite their obesity and kind of just went on and on and on, slagging off my readers, who, of course, paid my bills.
Mm.
So it wasn't a good move.
It was quite a populist down-market magazine, it has to be said, unashamedly so.
It wasn't quite. It was very, very down-market. It was, but it was fun. You know, it sold 600,000 a week and mainly sort of bought by middle-aged women on northern housing estates, sort of chain-smoking and, that sort of stuff. But fantastic true story. Kind of like, I guess, like Take Five or That's Life is over here. But it was a lot of fun.
And all about the cover lines, I should think, as well.
Yeah, we did have some bizarre cover lines. Things like, Mum's psychic message, the budgie's suicidal, and a bit of my pussy fell onto the carpet, and it was a cat. We had a lot of fun with it. Because in those days, the women's mags weren't much fun. They were kind of, it was quite dowdy and quite sort of boring. So I went in there and made it, we did launch the search for Britain's ugliest baby and sexiest fat bloke and sexiest bald bloke and those sort of things. And we launched a thing for Teen Mum of the Year, which, upset some people. We kind of just, because just doing true life stories can be a bit boring. Mm. So we figured, we'll sort of, play around with it and have some fun.
A lot of this was very PR friendly as well, wasn't it?
It was. We went, obviously, I went too far. We did win voluntary euthanasia for a loved one. We called it Love and Let Die. But unfortunately, the lawyers said we weren't allowed to do it. We were going to send with a serious thing, because if you if you've got someone who's sure. dying, then clearly the best thing for them is for them to have a peaceful release.
Yes.
And of course, that Swiss clinic, what's it called? The one where it's legal, where you go and you press a button and guess how much it costs just to go there, press the button and be killed at the Swiss clinic.
Including the travel?
Not including the travel.
That's okay.
How much would you think it would cost to end your life?
So you got your doctor for good. Couple of hours, I should.
Yeah,
they're going to charge you. Let's say you use your medical appointment for 10 minutes. It's like $80. So you'll get six of those in. So that'd be $480. 2 hours. They call it $1,000.
£49.
Really?
Which is it's cheap, isn't it? It's not a service you can use twice and benefit from a sort of a customer loyalty card. But it's it was only £49 plus. Obviously, the airfare to Switzerland was not huge.
Do EasyJet go to?
So I'm not sure if they do, but I don't know if they take the body back afterwards. I think that you to get a return trip with a dead body becomes a bit Weekend at Bernie's But but we weren't allowed to do that, sadly. But we did win a divorce and stuff like, which I later did on Zoo, actually.
Yes. Here. So, well, that was the thing. So after that's this weird thing that happens to editors is they're either experienced in a sector or they're an experienced editor, and sometimes they're parachuted into a completely new sector. So you were sort of still while you were working for IPC, which I guess is the sort of the equivalent to ACP over here. You were briefly on the launch team for Nuts, which was the weekly men's magazine, but then you crossed the floors and went over to EMAP to launch
Zoo. I did. It was very odd. Funnily enough, the reason that EMAP became interested in me was because of that disastrous interview. They saw that and a couple of them thought it funny and said, oh, you should give him a go. And, of course, I was the least likely person to then edit a lads mag. You know, I'm not, the sort of full-on lad. Mm-hmm. You know, my album collection's full of sort of Elton John and Billy Joel and none of these young people things. But I was, parachuted in at the last minute. There was a kind of a big old battle between the two companies because one wanted to keep me just 6 months' notice and the other said, no, you've got to go now. And so went over and it was a bit of a disastrous sort of launch, as you'll read in the book next year.
Yes.
So a little plug there. But then, it was fun. I did it for nearly 2 years and then... came over here.
And at the time, I mean, the men's mag market was still booming at that point, and this was the creation of the weekly men's mag. You know, monthlies, I guess, have been reinvented by Loaded magazine in particular. But this, how did it change doing it on a kind of weekly basis?
Well, what no one could work out is why no one had done a men's weekly before that, because as you say, Loaded launched in like 93 or 94. And FHM then on Loaded's coattails became a million-selling monthly, and it was boom time from nowhere. Before that, it had been GQ and Esquire and sort of, you know, very gentlemanly kind of stuff. There were no lads mags, so the market was booming, and then along came Zoo and Nuts, and it doubled, or I think it maybe quadrupled overnight. So it was a huge, huge time. This is in 2004. It was the biggest magazine launch in British history, Zoo and Nuts together. I think it still is.
It was great battles,
huge amounts of publicity. It became like sort of Blur Oasis kind of, tussle. And, of course, we ended up being the Blur, unfortunately, rather than the Oasis.
Well, I was going to ask, with the benefit of time, which do you think was the better product?
Well, I think with the benefit of... in fact, not even with the benefit of hindsight, I think at the time, I think Zoo was funnier and it was edgier. It was there was more life to it. But Nuts was brilliantly launched. They spent four times as much as we did on the initial launch. They were big and they were glossy. And we did all these research groups, all these sort of focus groups and pubs. And everyone would say, which one would you buy? They'd say, well, Nuts. I'd say, why? Well, it's bigger and it's glossy. Then they get to read it and they read every page and they prefer Zoo because, you know, Zoo had more attitude. And Nuts was perhaps more professionally designed and put together and just looked big and glossy. So in the first month, I think Nuts sold... in the first 2 weeks, I think Nuts sold nearly a million, and we sold about 400,000. Mm. So they left us at the starting gate, basically, and it was catch-up ever since. But by the time I left, we got the gap to about 30,000, and it was getting very close.
And you touched on this a little bit earlier, the fact that you weren't a typical lads mag editor. Do you think, you know, to me, one of the things that made Loaded work was these guys genuinely seem to be living that life.
Yes.
Versus kind of, the mental image that I'm sure the editor will want any reader to have is of this, you know, everything that the magazine espouses is the life the editorial team leads. Can you genuinely do a good men's mag if it's not the life you lead?
Well, I think we did, because basically I was never in the mag. I made sure that I never appeared in the mag. So the young lads who were working for me and the writers in their 20s who were, you know, looked like the sort of typical Zoo reader were the face of the magazine. They were the ones you saw. So even though I wasn't leading that life, I wasn't leading the life of a chat reader, you know, so I got success. I was successful at, you know, getting inside their brains and working out what they wanted. So no, I wasn't leading that life. But the other thing is, on a weekly, there's no time to lead that life. On Loaded, they did nothing, you know, mucked around for 3 weeks and then suddenly rushed it all through. On a weekly, you've got 100 pages every week they've got to get through. You've got no time to be going off, you know, sniffing cocaine off a supermodel's boobs. That's not going to happen on a weekly basis, or you're not going to get it out.
So your route into journalism is you came out through the local paper route.
Yes.
By local paper route, I don't mean you were a paper boy, but
no.
But yeah, and kind of we had this weirdly parallel thing that back in the early 90s, we both worked on the neighbouring local papers
we
on
did.
The Hampshire Surrey border.
So. Yes, I think again yours was probably more professionally put together than mine. Yes, back in the day, the Farnham Herald.
Which, and that was your first newspaper?
It was my first newspaper and my only newspaper, in fact, full-time. And, that was a bizarre thing to go from a sort of very stuffy weekly newspaper in the home counties to Chat magazine was a slightly strange leap. And then to go from Chat to Zoo was probably equally strange. So who knows what's next?
How did you find that transition? I mean, it's a complete shift in target audience, was it? Obviously, women to men. How mentally did you prepare for that? And
looking back, I don't think I was as prepared as I perhaps could have been, because I didn't instinctively know what young blokes in their 20s wanted. Luckily, I had a good team around me, and I made sure that their input was in the mag.
Yeah.
But I learned pretty quick. I think the first 3 or 4 months, I kind of learned what they wanted. Which basically wasn't that difficult to know. It was boobs, more boobs, and some sex advice, and some pictures of monkeys riding donkeys. That was kind of once you got that in, you're ticking all your boxes.
Yeah, there seems to be a lot of debate over men's magazine covers and the formula that works. Is it scantily clad women on the cover every week that sells men's magazines, or is it? Are we moving towards the age of a more discerning male reader?
Well, I don't know if blokes will ever be discerning, but what's interesting is when Loaded first started, and FHM, and then Maxim, of course, they were huge in the UK, then went to the US, and they were massive over there. And of course, you had Ralph and FHM over here, but 10 years ago, or which again, both very successful. And it was about seeing girls that you'd never seen in bikinis or lingerie before, famous girls. So, back in the day, it might have been Paris Hilton, it might have been Kelly Brook, or, Pamela Anderson, all these sort of women that were famous, and blokes was the only...
Denise Van Outen was another one.
Denise Van Outen, of course, but these were women who you couldn't really see naked or near naked elsewhere. So it was about the girls.
And how did you negotiate that sort of thing? What's the process?
Well, initially for the likes of FHM and Maxim and Loaded, no girls were ever paid to go on the cover. It was all thought of as such a great honour to be on the cover of these magazines that no one ever got paid. But latterly, of course, the image of these magazines went down. I think Zoo, I'm sure, was partly responsible for that, so that it didn't become such a great thing to want to be on the cover of the magazines. And the sales of all these magazines, of FHM and Loaded, were collapsing and still are collapsing. And we'll probably see some, fatalities, I reckon, in the next 12 months or so. I reckon Zoo UK is very vulnerable. I think, FHM over here. And, Maxim, of course, has just started. But what's changed is that it's no longer the women, I don't think, that people buy the magazines for, because they can get pictures of women anywhere now. They, on the internet or wherever they get, or on their mobile phone. So I think magazines need to go to the next stage of their evolution. So, of course, the most successful one over here at the moment is Men's Health, and that has never relied on women. Men's Health will peak and, eventually we'll get tired of that. But I think there is a change in dynamic, and I think that magazines can no longer just rely on the woman. It's got to be more to it, and that is why they're floundering at the moment, because they haven't really got their digital apps sorted out. They haven't got their websites are pretty poor, and they need to work out why blokes are going to buy these sort of brands in a digital age.
So when you heard that Maxim was launching, did you think there would be a gap in the market for it, or did you just think that sounds like a crazy thing to do?
It did sound like a crazy thing to do, because this was at a time when Ralph had closed, FHM was on the verge of closing, selling very, very few copies, and Men's Style, of course, no one really buys, and all these sort of, and you thought, well, why would Maxim work when Ralph didn't work, and Ralph had the backing of ACP? To be fair to, Santi's the editor, and I worked with him when I was editor-in-chief of Ralph, and he knows what he's doing. And I think the first two or three covers, I thought were great. You got Ruby Rose and was it Jennifer Hawkins and someone else who was, I thought was a really good get. He Ricky got, Lee
well,
Coulter.
Yes, I was going to say, he got her sort of first thinned down pictures, so to speak.
Yeah, and which was funny because we got her for Ralph about 2 years ago when she was curvy, and her whole interview was about how she's really proud of her curves and women should stand up for themselves if they're a little bit bigger and more curvy, and that's what blokes want. It's you know, it's really sexy. Now she's telling a story to Women's Day, you know, how I lost 25 kilos.
Thanks to my personal trainer boyfriend.
Yes, I feel better than ever. You know, thin is great. And it's, you think, oh, well, anyway. But yeah, Maxim, I think, is doing a good job. The magazine is strong.
And he is one of those editors who puts his photo in the magazine quite a lot.
Yes, yes. Well, he's probably living the life more than I was. But whether it will work long term, I don't know. I think their current cover is Selma Gomez, who isn't as well known. And my guess is, I don't think they're audited, are they? I don't think their circ's going to...
Not yet, I don't think.
I don't know whether it will be or not, but I don't see it as a long-term thing unless they take the sort of quantum leap and maybe consider putting a bloke on the cover.
Is the key to keeping it Australian, maybe? Because the first three girls you mentioned are all Aussies. Selma, Salima, whatever her name is a young sort of teeny American. I mean, does this come back to the idea of giving guys the girls that you haven't yet seen, well, scantily clad?
Possibly. I think on Zoo, almost all of our girls were Australian girls. And latterly, they weren't celebrities. You know, the first couple of years of Zoo, we did like Nikki Webster and a couple of sort of B-grade TV stars. And then, of course, all the Big Brother girls who were huge for us. All our biggest selling covers were Big Brother. I think in 2007, we had something like 12 out of 14 covers that were Big Brother, and they all sold through the roof. It was incredible.
So it could be good news for Zoo that Big Brother's coming
back. So
Big
Brother could be what saves Zoo, because that's, you know, we've done other well-known girls like, you know, The Farmer Wants a Wife or Let It to Lady and So You Think You Can Dance, stars from those shows. None of them really did very well, whereas Big Brother did seem to do well. So if Nine get it right and it's a success next year, which I'm sure they will, then that could be extremely exciting for Zoo.
So you mentioned a few of the stunts that you did with Chat. Which were your kind of your best stunts that you did for Zoo here in Australia then?
We did a few. What did we do? We brought the Spider-Man, you know, French Spider-Man, Alain Robert. We brought him a couple of times to climb tower blocks in the Sydney.
Yeah, so Max Markson would always profess his shock at the moment.
Yes,
Max was the PR guy.
I can't believe he climbed. Yeah, I know. But that was quite interesting to see the whole of the CBD sort of grind to a halt with about 20 police cars and, you know, police cordoning off pavements and helicopters buzzing overhead and rapid response units going into the building to bring this guy down. And
Was it a Zoo t-shirt or a Zoo hat?
Yeah, it had a Zoo t-shirt, which was, it had Zoo on the back and front, you know, bit of a, you know, so you could see him from the building. Huge amounts of publicity went around the world. And of course, you know, the amount of disruption, the amount of it must have cost the police. And he got fined, I think it was $150 or something like that for doing it. And then came back and did it again and got similar sort of sentence, which seemed to be a strange thing.
Does he pass that fine on to you? Or does that come with the cost of getting the French Spider-Man in?
We were as surprised as Max that he climbed the building, of course. We had no prior knowledge because clearly, you know, we could never admit to that. But that was fun. And
what's Max like to negotiate with?
Oh, Max is exactly as he comes over. There's no sort of TV persona for Max. That's exactly how he is.
See, this is the question I have, because we've dealt with Max a few times and, you know, done video interviews and stuff with him. And you see him at events and he's the same. The question is, do you think when he shuts the front door and goes inside, there's a different Max?
I would hope so. It would be impossible to live with, wouldn't he? Because unless he sort of just collapses in a heap at the end of the day, almost like a toy that's been wound up and finally it sort of goes... But he's an amazing character. He's a great guy.
And some of the other stunts that you...
Well, we did... we used to just send Zoo Man out to do things. So when the Pope was here for World Youth Day, we, you know, sent out the Zoo Pope to, you know, free condom with every confession. And we did win a lesbian wedding.
Was it you who did Australian Sexiest Feminist?
Yeah, we did. Well, only because we were getting complaints. So we thought, you know, we're discriminating against the feminists. So we thought we'd include them. But we didn't get... There were no entries for that.
Really? So they had to enter themselves, did they, then? That was the...
So to speak, yes. They were... no one entered that. We did win a boob job for your girlfriend, which went really well. got loads, hundreds of entries for that. Winner Circumcision, which obviously slightly fewer entries for that. But, you know, stuff like that was always fun. And sending Zoo Man around the country to, you know, when Queensland Rail, for example, banned Zoo from their depot, which, you know, was an outrageous thing to do. So we set up a stall outside, you know, handing them through the fence, like sort of, you know, like at a refugee kind of station. And then launched the search for Miss Queensland Rail to, you know, find the sexiest employee at Queensland Rail, you know, sort of doing our duty. But they banned us from the depot. So I then banned my staff from travelling on Queensland Rail as a sort of countermeasure. But it didn't bring them down, unfortunately.
Next, are we facing a POM shortage?
There's more to radio than music through your headphones. Radio can connect your brand with consumers in more ways than just over the airwaves. Check out the case study for Nissan MicroCitizen, where listeners were sent to LA, Barcelona and New York to get in sync with the city. Or the interview on how the Lady Gaga deal for Vodafone all-time prepaid was done. See that and more at seeradiodifferently.com.
On Tuesday, Treasurer Wayne Swan announced the government would withdraw the major tax perk, LAFA, or Living Away From Home Allowance, offered to overseas workers under the 457 business visa. The changes would come in as of July the 1st next year. Tim, how does it work?
Right, declaration of interest. You know, LAFA was one of the things that helped me come across, and in fact we're, as is sometimes the case, quite a POMI-heavy panel here today. But basically, it's an allowance that says that if you have another home somewhere else in the world or somewhere else in Australia, then you might be entitled to an allowance. And in practice, what that will often mean is people being brought over from the UK, seems to be where a lot of people come over from the media industry, then while you're on that 457 visa, you might be able to get all of your rent back against tax. So that's obviously a benefit for people coming across, because it means they, you know, they might as well live somewhere where the rent is quite high and, you know, quite attractive to live. It's also a benefit for employers, because firstly, they can probably pay these people slightly less than otherwise they would have to. And secondly, because you only pay super on the actual salary bit, and a big chunk of this is the what seems to be salary is actually now a rent allowance, employers end up probably paying half as much super as they otherwise would. So it's one of those things that was a very useful tool for bringing people across. The argument being, though, that A, it was rorted, which is what the government has been talking about, and B, you know, this was existing at a time when the pound was a lot stronger than the Australian dollar, and, you know, that situation has pretty much turned about. So, you know, maybe it's actually not needed as a tool. So it will be very interesting to see what happens. It's due to happen from next July. They've sort of signalled that there is a consultation period, but the sense is this will happen.
Yeah, and do you think it will mean an exodus of, as we've written, of Brits, of foreigners from the Australian media industry?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, I found as an editor when I'm trying to bring people over, for instance, when I've not been able to find someone locally, you know, it's part of that sales spiel where you sort of say, look, and, you know, I know the salary doesn't sound brilliant, but let me tell you about this thing called LAFA. You know, this might just persuade you. You know, I remember someone having that conversation with me when I first came over, and I was sort of saying, look, you know, this is a lot less than I'm earning at the moment or have been earning. And then they're explaining me, thinking, well, OK, that gives me a bit of comfort. So it's certainly going to be less easy to bring people over as a result, in my opinion.
Did you have that conversation with Robin?
I think I probably did, didn't I? When you were in Singapore, I'm sure I
did.
Yeah,
that was the carrot dangling in front of me.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry. It turns out I lied to you.
What is it that the government and the opposition, they're obsessed with stopping people coming to this country, are they? Maybe people on a 457 should be processed offshore in Nauru or something, kept in a detention centre for a few months, and then, just, you know, if they still want to come, then they're allowed in.
It would certainly help, you know, test whether people really are committed to the country and to the job, wouldn't it? Yeah.
Solution.
Paul, did you come over on a LAFA?
I did, and I rorted it outrageously. But it did help me, I think, because you get your accommodation is tax-free. Yes. So it does make a big difference. But I think it will stop, you know, people coming over to this country. And I think Australia, you know, needs to stem the brain drain. There is a perceived brain drain from Australia to the UK. But also that, you know, from New Zealand to Australia. And you think, well, that's why New Zealand has such low tax rates to keep people there. I don't know if they have a LAFA arrangements, but you've got to think, will this stop, you know, people, particularly in the, you know, say media, coming to Australia? Because, you know, you need the best people, whatever nationality they are.
Yeah. As a point made on Mumbrella, if that happened and New Zealanders stopped coming and Brits stopped coming, then the rent in Bondi would be much, much less.
It would collapse, yeah. I should think. Yes. Yeah.
Paul, your experience as a recruiter, obviously, did you find it difficult recruiting in Australia? And do you think it will become more difficult if Laffer goes?
I found it wasn't a problem recruiting junior positions. But for senior positions, there were several times when I was trying to recruit and got no applicants. So there were times when I did have to go looking abroad to find some people and coax them over. And the Laffer probably would, you know, tip the balance to make it worth their while.
Do you think now that the dollar has grown, is stronger, would you come over now with the dollar strong without a Laffer?
Well, to be honest, I reckon most people would come anyway. I mean, now that I'm not eligible for Laffer, I'm completely against it. I think it should be scrapped. But for the years that I claimed it, it was essential to me, and it would have gone back, you know, the next day had it been scrapped.
Right.
Next, what's happened to BMF?
This week, Mumbrella revealed that Martin Rippon, the MD of ad agency BMF, will return home to the UK in February. Something of a conversation going on this morning about expats. Rippon joined the company, that's BMF, in 2000. Jeremy Nicholas, BMF's boss, said, this is a quote, "I wish Martin well. He's made an enormous contribution to the business." Also moving on is the head of planning, Gareth Cooper. And what's more, the agency has also announced that its team of about 240 staff will split its client portfolio into three separate teams, two in Sydney and one in Melbourne. Now, Robin, lots of ramifications around this. Maybe start with Martin Rippon. He was someone who was specifically mentioned when you took a look at BMF as part of the creative agency review, which you wrote.
Yeah, a very highly regarded planner, a real linchpin for the agency, a good planner as well as an MD. It should be noted that the first thing, we received a press release, didn't we, from BMF, announcing that they'd got so big that they had to split into three. They said that agencies only work well with between 50 and 100 staff. They're now approaching 300, so it makes sense to divide that the agent. The
and it was a classic bit of PR where the big part of the story wasn't mentioned in the story.
It wasn't mentioned
well.
At all. Yeah, we received a call to actually fill us in on what was happening. But then we found out that Martin Rippon was leaving as head of planning, Gareth Cooper. Yeah, no, a theory as to why BMF is dividing also is that they are preparing for a very important pitch, CommBank. They've got part of the business. They're going for all of it.
Yes. One thing to mention, actually, is I just looking on, as we're recording this on my mobile, I suspect by the time this podcast goes up tomorrow, there might be some more information on that as well. We may know either way whether BMF are actually through to the next round.
Yes, yeah. And I suspect the real story is that BMF is re-engineering its agency to make room for CommBank, which is a $100 million account.
What about the other team members? So we're seeing this Sydney team led by head of account management, Chris Kay, Dylan Taylor running the other Sydney team, and then the Melbourne team led by creative director David Klein. I suppose of those, probably Dylan Taylor is probably the best known of the three, at least in terms of profile within the industry.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think also it must be pointed out that the CEO, Jeremy Nicholas, insisted that the Martin Rippon leaving and the rejigging of the agency are two entirely separate things. It seems to be BMF have had a great year. They've wobbled a little bit towards the end, and they're shaking up to gear themselves for 2012.
Next, Google eats our lunch while we're in the toilet.
Speaking at the Walkley conference in Brisbane, David Higgins, News Limited's innovations editor, warned that the news industry was going down the toilet while Google and Apple ate our lunch. Tim, so you're at the conference. What is Higgins talking about?
Yeah, it's a brilliant mixed metaphor, isn't it? One of the best ones ever. It's funny, actually. I felt some sympathy for David Higgins, who you for those people who are on Twitter may know as at Cowspanker, in that the point he was really trying to make wasn't, as I think when I read the comment stream, it wasn't a moan about, oh, woe is us, Google's, you know, Google's the enemy of traditional newspapers, etc. The point he was making is we've got to find new ways of telling stories. You know, as journalists, it's not enough just to bash out the story anymore. So the sort of examples he was using was, you know, having JavaScript or HTML5 developers right there in the newsroom, so that one of the examples that somebody else on the panel was talking about was the Brisbane floods, where they were able to put together just a really simple visual thing where they got before and after pictures of the flooding of the same spot, and you're you're able just to run a finger from side to side along the image if you're on an iPad or your mouse on the computer, just bring the line back and forth across the picture so you could actually sort of make an absolute comparison on the images. And that was, you know, just a really simple example that got loads and loads of sort of views, but a new way of telling stories. Also talked about things like there's a platform called Storify that lets you pull in, you know, tweets about a story and, you know, maybe something from YouTube, you know, put everything in one place. So all of these things going on and making the point that, you know, media organisations need to wake up to that.
Yeah, and presumably train young aspiring journalists to be multimedia journalists.
Yeah, exactly that. Whether it's video shooting or editing skills or audio recording or editing skills, you know, all of those other things as well.
Yes. Paul, what about your stuff when you're on Zoo and your other titles? How multimedia literate were they? And what do you think this says about that sort of new dawn of the next generation of journalists?
I think magazines have been very slow in adjusting to the digital area. We have iPad apps for some limited magazines, but not many. And websites are still a little bit of an afterthought, I think. And there aren't enough magazines where the journos are doing what you said and going out on stories with their video cameras and, you know, putting stuff up on both mediums at the same time. Newspapers are much better, I think, in the last few years. And I think magazines need to wake up to that and they need to move a bit quicker. And, you know, anyone who rages against Google is like raging against the tide for coming in. It's, you know, it's not, nothing's going to change.
Sure.
I think people have got to sort themselves out.
Yes. I'll tell you one thing I've been trying to think to myself about this, and there obviously is a point, you know, there's only so much that any single journalist can do, you know, and if you're not only interviewing someone, but you're capturing the audio, capturing the video, coming back to the office, cutting it up, doing all of these other things, possibly needing some coding skills in the future as well. Clearly the danger is that you don't do the best interview, you don't have the time to build the contacts, all these other skills. So I'm almost wondering whether, you know, we've talked about the day of subs potentially coming to an end, you know, we've seen it outsourced from Fairfax and so on, whether actually the future model is you get your story getting reporter who might be the one in front of the camera, but then you almost borrow from the TV model of the producer. So you pair a reporter with a producer, or the producer might work with two or three reporters.
I think that assumes a level of resource that just isn't there at the moment. And I think the way magazines and, well, in fact, the whole media is going is stripping out costs, and there's going to be a lot more stripping out next year. So at the moment, you've got one journo going out on a story. If he videos it, number one, he's got to set the video up, and, you know, you've got the talent waiting there for the 5-minute slot. And then who's going to, you know, to edit video takes time that he probably doesn't have. So I think, you know, if the resource is adjusted, which I don't think it will be initially, then yes, it can be done. And that's how media brands, magazine brands should be. So they should exist as apps just as much as in print. But I can't see that happening over the next year or two.
I suppose it's something that you do yourself, isn't it, Robin? I mean, you'll sometimes just take out the handycam when you're going to do an interview with someone. Does it sort of cramp your style, do you think?
A little bit, yeah. I'm not the most technically gifted journalist, so it means that I can capture content quickly, but I just feel comfortably, given my background, with a pen and paper or a laptop, getting it down. But video, yeah, it doesn't come naturally, and it's something I have to get used to, I suppose.
It should be pointed out that the editing is generally handed to someone else, isn't it, Robin? Someone else does
that's
the editing
right,
on
shoot
that.
It, and you yeah. can...
so sometimes there is a producer, yeah. sort of.
And then Colin tidies it up.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. Turning our attention back to the Walkley Awards, ABC won the most accolades with 8 awards, while both News and Fairfax picked up 7. One notable winner was WikiLeaks in the most outstanding contribution to journalism category. Tim, what do you think this says about the old guard of media?
Yes.
That WikiLeaks won a journalism award?
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I'm sure that, you know, for instance, Fairfax, which actually got a lot of the WikiLeaks cables, would try and argue that that actually they, you know, that they deserved the awards and that WikiLeaks was the source. You know, because you know that's the question: is when does something become a journalistic organisation?
Well, didn't WikiLeaks for the American papers they released or the documents, there was something like 250,000 communiques or even more than that. And Julian Assange said that he hadn't read them all. It's almost like he just, you know, loads them up and puts them out there. And you're right, it's people like Fairfax. And in the UK, it was
The Guardian.
The Guardian, who waded through them and picked out the little, you know, gems amid all the sort of the boring tosh, which is 99.9% of it. So is WikiLeaks journalism, or is it just pressing a button and putting it up online and people can, you know, digest it?
And I'd love to know if there's some politics going on as well, because I know that you detected from, you know, News Limited's arrival to Fairfax, this sort of annoyance that this cache of cables that, you know, that the Herald, the critics would say, sat on these cables as well, rather than making them more generally available. So I almost wonder whether maybe giving it to WikiLeaks rather than to the Herald was perhaps score settling of some part as well, perhaps.
Yeah, so it seems fairly even between ABC News and Fairfax for picking up awards. There's any sense that there's a shift in power between who is the top media organisation?
Do you know what? Yeah, it was very, very close. As you say, it was 877. And it's kind of funny, really, because a few years back, you know, News Limited used to get really frustrated at not winning anything, so they set up their own awards, whereas now, you know, they you know, they're far more in the main game as well. I think the other highlights for me were, it was really nice seeing Hungry Beast get something, which was the ABC sort of young, you know, show sort of from lots of sort of young and untalented people. So, you know, that was a good one to get. But yeah, I guess this is the way it always goes. You know, Seven picked up a few. Again, I don't remember anything for Nine. You know, they, you know, obviously in terms of sort of journalistic endeavour, you know, Nine have less, you know, less things which are likely to win than something like the ABC. But yeah, not a great year for them again.
Yeah. Next, The Week in TV.
Thinking of working at an ad agency? Looking for the best creatives to develop your next ad campaign? Look no further than the Mumbrella Creative Agency Review. 148 pages of hardcore industry intelligence to help you make your next big agency decision. Visit book.focalattractions.com.au/MCAR.
So the TV ratings year has come to a close. While The Block's finale was the single highest rating programme of the year, that's if we exclude sport, with 3.37 million viewers tuning in, Australia's Got Talent's regular Tuesday show was on average the most watched show in any given week. MasterChef also did pretty well for 10, with its shows hanging around on average on the sort of somewhere between 5th to 12th. But, you know, overall for 10, it wasn't a great year. Its second best show was NCIS, which actually rated 35th for the year. For the ABC, Doc Martin, that reliable old classic, did best in 18th place, while The Grin Transfer ranked 34th, although did particularly well in the younger demographics. So, yeah, you know, not a bad mix altogether.
Yeah, Paul, any TV highlights for you this year? You're a TV watcher?
Well, I am, but I find very little to watch on the main free-to-air networks. Well, I think what's depressing about Australian TV, which I think is more so than perhaps it was in the UK, is that all programmes have to be aimed at stupid people to be successful. So if it doesn't get a million viewers on its launch, then it's a failure. So something like Hamish and Andy's Gap Year, which I thought was a good show for people in their 20s, but is not going to be that interesting to older people. It was deemed a failure because it dipped down to about 500,000. We think, well, those 500,000, surely there are advertisers who would want to target them, but no, it's got to be a million, or it's a failure. It seems a strange system that shows can be, like the Ben Elson show, which wasn't, I don't think, a disaster that people said it was, but of course it's now gone down in history as a disaster because, you know, it got so few viewers. You think, well, why can't that exist in a later slot and not matter quite as much? So it's depressing that it's just reality TV now and talent shows that's the only ones guaranteed to get over a million, and the old pack to the rafters. So, you know, it's for anyone who wants something a bit more intelligent, there really isn't anywhere to go, is there, apart from ABC?
Yeah.
And pay television.
Yeah.
On average, across the free-to-air, Pack to the Rafters was third, and Underbelly was, I think, 10th across the year. So, and there was actually only about 10 drama or comedy productions that made it into the top 100.
Well, it's a credit to Nine that they've stuck with Underbelly and invested a considerable amount of money in it. So, you know, kudos to... It was Eddie McGuire, wasn't it, who commissioned it originally?
It was. He certainly championed it, and it probably was in his brief CEO-ship. That
it was, yeah. And I think, you know, fair play to that. I assume there are more to come.
Yes,
next
there
year.
Is. Yeah, I went along to the upfronts just over a week ago, and it appeared very briefly in the highlights reel. Very big tashes.
So, oh, really?
That could be because it's a New Zealand one.
Yeah. Do you know?
There's
I'm not
Land
sure
of the Long Green Cloud is
that what it is?
Well, there is a New Zealand one. Whether it'll be shown here?
Oh, yeah.
I'm
no,
sure
it's, I don't
be,
think that's the one they were teasing. Though I think it's possibly back in Melbourne. I think for the next one.
Okay.
Next, Foxtel to launch catch-up TV.
There's more to radio than music for your headphones. Radio can connect your brand with consumers in more ways than just over the airwaves. Check out the case study for Nissan Micro Citizen, where listeners were sent to LA, Barcelona and New York to get in sync with the city. Or the interview on how the Lady Gaga deal for Vodafone all-time prepaid was done. See that and more at seeradiodifferently.com.
Catch-up TV is set to launch across the Foxtel network in March or April, according to Anthony Fitzgerald, CEO of pay TV house MCN. There will be no further cost to the subscriber, with access via set-top boxes connected to the internet. The announcement on Monday came just 3 days after APC boss Mark Scott complained that free-to-air networks had been unable to work together. So, Tim, do the free-to-air channels need an all-in-one sort of catch-up platform when they have... when they all have their own?
I suppose it's that sort of stumble-on factor, isn't it, is the opportunity. What people talk about a lot is Hulu, which is the service in the US, which carries content from a lot of different networks. So, you know, the Mark Scott's speech, which again was at the Walkley's conference, was talking about, why can't we work together for a Hulu for Australia? And he made the point that, yeah, you know, the ABC was even potentially happy to provide the infrastructure, but they hadn't agreed to work together. Now, of course, what we'll probably see is Foxtel nip in there first. Still, you've got to be a Foxtel subscriber in the first place, obviously, but they're just to that point where, you know, IPTV is becoming a reality, you know, just large amounts of content delivered via the internet rather than, you know, broadcast via satellite or cable. So that game is going to change. And what it may also do in time is where homes at the moment are reliant, you know, particularly in kind of urban areas and these big apartments, a lot of the services that Foxtel offer actually aren't available there because they've got very basic cabling. So, you know, I suspect there's a potential market they're not getting to kind of in the urban areas that once the main delivery pipe is the internet, they will be able to. So you can see why it's an opportunity for the likes of Foxtel.
Yeah, and you think there'll be the appetite for it, for catch-up TV? As a model, you think Australia will go for it? Australian viewers will want to use this
certainly
sort of service?
Certainly, Hulu has been successful.
Yeah.
There are some amazing numbers from the ABC for their player. Every now and then you do see releases from the individual networks, but how particular shows have done well as well on their own catch-up platform. So yeah, there absolutely is a hunger there. You know, the quote from Mark Scott, if you're still asking what's on television tonight, you're showing your age, exactly makes that point. It's about people finding what they want when they want it.
Paul, so how do you consume your viewing? Would you use a service like this? Does it interest
I think
you?
I would, but I'm just wondering when the tipping point will come and when we get it fully through the internet, perhaps when the NBN's fully rolled out, as to when we'll be able to watch TV anywhere in the world. So why can't we watch the American networks just live as they're being broadcast in Australia, or the British ones, or wherever it is, be it Al Jazeera or New Zealand or whatever? In which case, if you want to watch, I don't know, Mike and Molly, you wouldn't have to watch it on Channel 9. It would be just straight from whoever produces it. I wonder whether we're getting close to that in a couple of years, whether it will move to a point where there are no TV schedules, just a series of effectively, you know, podcasts of a new locally produced show that's released globally.
I don't think I've ever heard someone use the phrase "I want to watch Mike and Molly."
No, I don't know why I plucked. That's worrying, isn't it? Why did I pluck Mike and Molly out there? It's very strange.
But a VoIP could do that, right? It'd call me a Luddite, but that would work.
Probably not quite VoIP, which is more sort of a voice protocol. The voice.
So I am a Luddite. What is it that I'm looking at?
Looking for IPTV would be the.
But there's
which is internet protocol television.
But there's an international IP address. system.
Ah, right, right, right. You mean in terms of being able to access the overseas content?
Yeah, Hulu.
But that's a way of getting around the copyright restrictions as much as anything. But
which we don't condone.
Which
correct?
We clearly don't condone.
No.
But I guess almost the model you're thinking of, Paul, is that actually this is content. So why not, you know, why not localize the ads and let people access it as it's there? You know, you'll get your Doctor Who fans, and they will, if there's not a legal version of downloading it, they'll find an illegal version.
I just want a future world where Mike and Molly can be watched 24 hours a day across all platforms.
And who doesn't want that? That is all we have time for today. Thank you very much to Paul.
No problem.
To Robin.
Cheers, Tim.
And to Colin.
Thank you, Tim.
The Mumbrella Cast was recorded in the studios of CBS Interactive. See you next week. Toodle-pip.
On Tuesday, Treasurer Wayne Swan announced the government would On Tuesday, Treasurer Wayne Swan announced the government would withdraw the major tax quota.
We can do this. We can do it together.
On Tuesday, Treasurer Wayne Swan announced the government.
Sorry. I was laughing over the second time.
On Tuesday, Treasurer Wayne Swan announced the government would withdraw.
Luckily, we have our takes at the end of the.
I'll get there.